From Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer. This is The Exchange. Years ago, a high-profile case involving the death of a two-year-old from Spirit Lake focused attention on the state's system for protecting children. It prompted numerous changes in the DHS and brought much attention to the problem of child abuse in the state. This hour, we look at the challenges of a changing child welfare system with my guests, Mary Nelson, who recently retired as the administrator of the Child and Family Services Division with the Iowa DHS, Gail Barber, director of Iowa Children's Justice, Denise Moore, parent partner coordinator with the Iowa DHS, and Stephen Scott, executive director for Prevent Child Abuse Iowa. That's all coming up. First, a look at this news. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. You may remember reports of a tragic child death in Iowa 10 years ago this month. In January of 2000, a high-profile case involving the death of two-year-old Shelby Dewis from Spirit Lake at the hands of her mother's boyfriend focused attention on the state's system for protecting children. It prompted numerous changes at Iowa's Department of Human Services and brought much attention to the problem of child abuse in the state. But the approach to child welfare tends to swing in a pendulum, as we'll find out. A high-profile case like that of Shelby Dewis swings the pendulum toward protecting the child versus family preservation. Well, where is that pendulum now, and what creative solutions have been found in the meantime? This hour we want to examine the challenges of the state's changing welfare system with my first guest, Mary Nelson, who recently retired after 35 years with the DHS. And as a longtime administrator of the Child and Family Service Division, Nelson has been the state's top official for policy and procedures on how to address child abuse and neglect. Mary Nelson joins us this afternoon in Iowa Public Radio studios in Des Moines. Good afternoon, Mary.
Good afternoon.
You have a tremendous and valuable, unique, long view on this that stretches back over more than three decades. Describe the major ways in which the child welfare system here in Iowa has changed over time, perhaps starting off with what you see as the most significant change.
I think probably one of the most significant changes is that we're much more focused on outcomes, on how to and I have an ability to measure whether kids are safe, whether we're moving them towards a permanent family. So we're more focused on those outcomes, and we're better able to measure how well we're doing.
As compared with previous to that, how was achievement measured?
It was largely measured by what your experiences were, what you were familiar with. We had periodic evaluations. I mean, we could count we could tell every year how many kids were abused, but we didn't have good data on how many were re-abused, how many kids that had been abused once were abused again. We might occasionally we would be able to contract with a university to do an evaluation, but we didn't have the kind of routine feedback that we have today.
I see. So you had a system in place that you thought helped, but you didn't track, so you didn't know for sure. And now that tracking has become better and better, and you learn from the results, I assume.
Absolutely. And there's more research out there. There's also a lot more known about what's effective in addressing child abuse. Mm-hmm. I think another significant change is we've done a much a stronger job engaging the community in supporting families. There's been a real recognition that the department isn't the only safety net for kids and families, but that we need all parts of the community. And a significant partner in that, I think, that has gotten much more involved, or that we collaborate much more with, is the court.
Mm-hmm. Just in families, I'm thinking of your last comment about the public's awareness of child abuse. Our society has really changed in the way parents and the way we all treat children, hasn't it? I mean, it wasn't too many decades ago that corporal punishment was the rule in most families.
Absolutely.
And that's close to child abuse, though, right? Or it can lead to it.
No, corporal punishment is not the same as child abuse. Certainly taken to an extreme, it does become child abuse. I think one of the things to remember, though, is much of child abuse is actually neglect. Kids not being adequately supervised, not having proper adequate food. So it isn't just physical abuse.
Mm-hmm. What about the coming of the Child Abuse Registry? How has that helped? Tell us about that and remind us what that is.
Well, the Child Abuse Registry is a centralized listing of all the incidents of child abuse. It includes both the victims, so the information about the children that have been abused, as well as information about the perpetrators, mm-hmm. the individual that's committed the abuse. Well, it certainly allows us, and it's part one of the sources of our ability to know if kids are abused again. It allows us to know where are our reports coming from? You know, are we getting reports from doctors, from teachers? Who's getting abused? What ages of kids are most at risk for abuse? So it has, keeping data on child abuse has enabled us to know more about and what's going on and to address it more appropriately. The other feature of the specifically related to the registry is that it's used to check in more and more over the years cases of employment or for someone who wants to be a foster parent. So there's a check against the registry to see if they have a confirmed report or a founded report, I should say, on child abuse.
Mm-hmm. When you look back over the more than three decades that you've been doing the work for the DHS, do you see any unhelpful trends that have popped up, perhaps not policies that you put in place, just societal trends that you see make it even more complicated for you?
Well, certainly the increased incidence of drug abuse has put more kids and families at risk. That's something that I think changed over the years that I've been involved in child welfare.
Mm. Give us a step back and let's get even a bigger picture. What are the guiding principles when you look at policies and procedures on how to address child abuse and neglect? When it comes to those policies and procedures, what are those guiding principles?
Well, certainly one of the most important is child safety, that we need to be focused on children's safety, on their health and well-being. At the same time, another important principle is to recognize that parents and family is essential for kids to have a healthy childhood and to grow up to be productive adults. So we need to engage their families when we can and do what we can to preserve the family.
Mm-hmm. How has the bad economy affected the child welfare services in the state, or is this measurable? Can you tell?
Well, I think certainly economic stress is just one more stressor that families experience. And so when more people are unemployed, when poverty increases, that places more pressure on families.
Mm-hmm. And the result for the children can be what?
Well, I think it can one of the things that can happen as a result of stress is kids may be at more risk for physical abuse. It also means there, some of the economic pressures kids may have less access to food, shelter. I mean, more homelessness.
Mm-hmm. Parents are just more on the edge, of course, when they're faced with a dire economic situation and may take that out on their kids. And we have to protect against this?
Oh, absolutely. And it can also increase the incidence of substance abuse when parents are under stress. And again, that's a significant risk factor for abuse and neglect.
What about how concerned are you that severe budget shortfalls may affect child welfare services in the state?
Well, certainly I think that's one of the more challenging things before us right now. And, over the 35 years I've worked in child welfare, we've had other times when revenues have been tight. And that places a lot of pressure on all state programs, and certainly child welfare is one of them. We've had to make reductions in the last year, and that's very hard.
Mm-hmm. Can you predict the outcomes of giving less of the budget to the DHS? What trends will we like to see when we have less monies going towards the DHS programs and services?
Well, certainly, you know, I think it places increased pressure on our providers. You know, in this last round, we did reductions in our payments rates to providers. We also had to reduce some of our spending on child abuse prevention, which I think, you know, increases the risk for kids. We had to reduce payments, our maintenance reimbursement to foster and adoptive parents, which can hurt recruitment. All of those things can, mm-hmm. you know, reduce the resources that are available to help support families.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned foster care. Looking back over the decades that you've been at work, what improvements or changes have been made in the foster care system in the state?
Well, we do a much better job now of training foster parents. You know, when I first started, I don't think we didn't do any training before foster parents were licensed, and we didn't have training available to them on an ongoing basis. And that's all in place now. We provide a lot more support through, for example, the Iowa Foster and Adoptive Parents Association. They are able to provide foster parents to sort of mentor each other and support each other. And that's foster parents face some real challenges, and it's really important that we provide them the training they need and the support they need.
Mm-hmm. Are children staying in foster care indefinitely, or are they able to move into permanent homes more quickly than before?
Over the years, I think that's another area where we've made significant improvements, and I think part of that is the role of the court, as well as things that the department's done. But we really do not see kids, in most cases, staying in foster care for long periods of time. We're either successfully returning them to their parents' home safely, or we're moving them on towards a permanent adoptive family.
Can you point to statistics about how Iowa here would compare with other states?
Well, one of the things that's changed along, you know, I mentioned earlier, just the whole measurement of outcomes, is now the federal government reviews the performance of all the states and holds us to national standards. And so, for example, on something like children being safe in foster care, we are doing consistently do better in terms of keeping kids safe in foster care than the national standard is.
Mm-hmm. How is the state doing as far as recruiting foster parents, particularly within minority populations?
Well, that's an area that I think we continue to need to do better. We are doing a lot in that area. We do have increased diversity of our foster parents, but that's something we really need to continue to work on.
Okay, very good. We'll have to take a short break and come back with Mary Nelson. Mary Nelson recently retired as the administrator of the Child and Family Services Division after 35 years of work with the Iowa Department of Human Services. We're talking today about the challenges of a changing child welfare system, trying to get the long view on this. And perhaps you have something to add to our conversation. Do you believe Iowa's child welfare system has changed for the better, for the worse? What priorities should be placed on child protection, child abuse prevention during these tough budget times? Perhaps Iowa's child welfare services have touched your life, and you'd like to make a comment or have a question. 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100, or email us, theexchange@iowapublicradio.org. We'll be back with Mary Nelson and others when we continue. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. Talking about the challenges of a changing child welfare system this hour on The Exchange, I'm Ben Kiefer talking with Mary Nelson, recently retired after 35 years with the DHS, and she's in our studio at Iowa Public Radio in Des Moines. Also joining her at the table there, a number of other guests we want to include in our conversation this hour. Gail Barber is director of Iowa Children's Justice with the State Court Administration. Denise Moore, parent partner coordinator with the Iowa DHS, and Stephen Scott, executive director for Prevent Child Abuse Iowa. Welcome to you all. Are you there?
Yes, we are.
Okay. Everybody's so polite, waiting for the other ones to respond. Let's start with you, Gail, if we could, director of Iowa Children's Justice with the State Court Administration. Mary mentioned in our last segment the courts a couple of times. I want to ask you about that. Broadly speaking, how does justice in our courts change when a child is involved?
I think
over time, there's been a great increase in terms of attention toward child welfare cases. The federal government, about 14 years ago, decided that all the courts needed to pay more attention to children in court, and so they created grants for every state to help them focus. And that's where Children's Justice or Court Improvement Project came from. One of the things that Iowa has done is early on, before that even started, assign special judges to the juvenile court bench. And so they've had some specialized training that so they know more about those kinds of cases, and they know more about how to conduct those kinds of hearings so that kids can be incorporated into the courtroom and parents have opportunity to be heard. And as recently as the last couple of years, foster parents also have the right and responsibility to be heard in the courtroom.
Can you make this more concrete by giving us a case, a courtroom case where a specific lesson had been learned you can point to and say, this is why we do it differently now than we did in years before?
I don't know if I can think of a specific case, but
certainly a type of case, perhaps.
Certainly, one of the things that has happened, actually, that the federal government decided that states needed to improve, where kids were languishing in foster care for 4, 5, sometimes 10 years. And so they made a very concrete effort to say that will no longer be okay. And all of the states, including Iowa, worked very carefully with the Department of Human Services, with clear court oversight, to move those kids either to a permanent placement or to back home to their families in a safe way. And that really started in about 1997 and through 2000. So since then, they've monitored, like Mary said, with our federal guidelines and our outcomes. And so the expectation is that kids will no longer be in foster care more than 2 years unless there's a very definitive plan about moving them into independent living or aging out of the system. So most kids go home and safely, and kids that don't get to are adopted or move into guardianships with relatives.
Mm-hmm. What do you see as the greatest difficulties in cases of child abuse and neglect when you're balancing the rights of the birth parents with those of foster parents who want to adopt the children they've been caring for? How does a court strike that balance? What are the principles you use?
Well, if the court really has made a focus that children belong with their families as long as they can be safely maintained there. So the preference always is for a child to go to return home unless there's a very specific reason that it would be unsafe for them to do that. So focus is always on maintaining kids in their home. And then secondly, if they can't be maintained, into foster care for a very short time period while they work, the Department of Human Services and providers work with the families to remedy whatever situation it was that made it unsafe. And then if that's not possible for them to return home, then to concurrently be looking at some other permanent placement for those children.
Let me turn now to Stephen Scott, Executive Director for Prevent Child Abuse Iowa. Stephen, Prevent Child Abuse Iowa, founded in 1975. To end child abuse in the entire state of Iowa. How far have you come in this mission?
That's a very good question. We, going by the numbers recently, have done somewhat better, are far from where we want to be. The abused children numbers have increased actually because of Shelby Dewis, at least in terms of the confirmed cases. And we're now back from what had been an all-time high at the height of the meth manufacturing and meth use period.
Have you seen increased cases of child abuse due to the economic hard times we've had in the recent months?
We didn't see that in the last part of 2008. The 2009 numbers aren't out, so we don't know that yet. Certainly, we know that that puts more stress on families, and the possibility of neglect occurring and possibly physical injury would certainly be higher.
I don't know. Do you have numbers in front of you or in your head giving some numbers across the state to the child abuse percentages or numbers of cases?
Yes. The number of children confirmed abuse was less than 10,000 until the year 2000, when it went up to about 12,700 by 2001, and that was, again, right after Shelby Dewis's death. Mm-hmm. Reached almost 15,000 by 2003, went over 15,000 by 2005, and now is down to 12,200.
Mm-hmm. How confident are you that there is child abuse that takes place, undoubtedly, that we don't find out about, but there is the challenge of finding out about as much as possible. How much is still hidden compared to how much is reported?
Very good question again. I'm more confident that we are more aware of what goes on. And again, part of that is because of the trauma for a lot of our citizens from the Shelby Dewis case and subsequent reports of harm to children. We know that some abuse, such as sexual abuse, from studies tends to be underreported by 2-3 times what we actually find out about.
Mm-hmm. Have societal norms changed to help you in terms of awareness, that families being decades ago perhaps more closed to this, and that, you know, you didn't talk about what happened in the house 2 doors down?
Yes, significantly so. And sexual abuse would be one area where that has changed quite a bit. Much more awareness of that. We can see, looking at the recent reports on priest abuse, how much of that occurred in the 50s, 60s, and 70s with very little awareness of what was, to us, very questionable behavior, and yet that was not looked at with the kind of suspicion it would be looked at today.
Mm-hmm. So now there are more antenna up in neighborhoods, more awareness, and not quite the reluctance of reporting suspicious behavior.
I think that's certainly true.
Why was your organization founded in 1975 outside of the Department of Human Services? Why not simply take care of this mission from within the DHS?
The organization actually started in 1975 to create basic awareness of child abuse. Going back to when Mary started, that was not at all widely known, let alone there were no significant strategies to approach it. In 1982 is when the legislature adopted a law that set up the Iowa Child Abuse Prevention Program and did put it outside of DHS. I think one reason for that was it would be very easy for resources and attention to go toward the most serious, most traumatic cases, as opposed to putting resources on the front end, on the prevention end. And I think by moving it outside, that made that less likely to happen. In addition, the legislation created a very strong community base for prevention, with local community groups and nonprofits doing that work. And I think it's easier to have the nonprofit community organize that kind of effort than to have it organized with government in terms of the community having some sense that it owns it.
Stephen Scott is Executive Director for Prevent Child Abuse Iowa, one of our guests today as we look at the challenges of changing child welfare system. Mary Nelson with us as well. 35 years, she's recently retired after 35 years with the Iowa DHS. Also Gail Barber, Director of Iowa Children's Justice with the State Courts Administration. And Denise Moore, Parent Partner Coordinator with the Iowa DHS. Denise, we haven't gotten to you yet. We will when we come back after a short break. And we want to invite our listeners to join our conversation with any comments or questions. 1-866-780-9100 or email us, theexchange@iowapublicradio.org. We'll be back in just a few minutes. And we're back with The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Today, talking about our child welfare system, child welfare services in the state, and how they've changed it over the decades, what we've learned, what sort of creative solutions have we come up with and problems that have been encountered along the way. Mary Nelson is with us, recently retired as administrator of the Child and Family Services Division at the DHS after 35 years. Gail Barber, director of Iowa Children's Justice with the State Court Administration. And Denise Moore, parent partner coordinator with the Iowa DHS. Stephen Scott, executive director for Prevent Child Abuse Iowa. We'd like you to join our conversation in the remainder of the hour. Perhaps you're a foster parent, a former foster parent, or a former foster child. What is your critique of the system? What did you find worked well? What could be improved? 1-866-780-9100. Teachers, daycare providers, what have you seen change in terms of our children, our services for child welfare in this state? 1-866-780-9100 or The Exchange at iowapublicradio.org. We haven't been to Denise Moore yet, parent partner coordinator with the Iowa DHS. Tell us about this program, Denise. What is the parent partner program? How does it work?
The parent partner program is a program that has parents that have had their children removed due to various reasons. Could it be substance abuse, domestic violence, mental health reasons, and have reunited with their children and went through the child welfare system successfully, and now they go back and mentor other parents that are involved in the system or mm-hmm. that are coming into the system.
So explain, maybe obvious, but explain why that works so well. You have someone who's been through the system, a model of success, that there is a light at the end of the tunnel.
Yeah, I think the most important thing that we do, I'm also a parent, I'm a parent partner, and I think the most important thing that we do is inspire the families that they too can have a different life and be with their kids, and their kids will be healthy and happy and successful, and we give them hope that that can happen.
Mm-hmm. So when you look back 10, 20 years, how is the child welfare system different for a parent who comes into contact with a DHS today from your perspective?
Well, there's been numerous changes. I would say one of the most important or valuable things is the family team meetings. It individualizes the services for the family. The families have a voice in the services that they receive. They're part of the process. A team is built around the family that follows them all the way through the system and helps them to reach their goals for their mm-hmm. cases.
With parent partner program, what would you say, you have a way to measure your success rate? So talking about early, how are we now very, very focused on results?
I would say it's going to be difficult because there's so many variables in deciding what was the deciding factor to make a family successful. I think that we mentor and we guide them and we show them help them understand what the processes are, the language is, and I think that they're more aware of what's happening around them and able to complete their case.
Mm-hmm. From your perspective, how long have you been the coordinator for Parent Partner Program?
I'm a parent partner, but I've been with Parent Partners from the very beginning, and I've been there since it started as in five sites and pilot site. I'm in Polk County, mm-hmm. and I started at the beginning, and I think it was 3 years ago.
Mm-hmm. What are the other sites, if you know offhand?
There's Northwest Iowa, Warren County, Cedar Rapids. We're expanding all through the state now. So
okay. Now, read about, listen to, hear about the budget problems our state is encountering and will likely encounter in the next fiscal year, we see these tough budgetary times with us and looming in the future. What are you most concerned about when you look at the work that you do?
Well, I have a fear that our voices might get lost in the system, that we would backtrack on the work and the headway that we've made with working with families and keeping them together. I mean, that's a fear of mine. I also fear for the families that are out there. You know, we do a lot of work with Community Partnership for Protecting Children, and I think connecting the families and the community to resources that they need to keep their families successful and stable and happy.
Thank you. Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100, or email us the exchange at iowapublicradio.org. iowacivic.org. Nick is joining us from Iowa City. Good afternoon, Nick.
Hello?
Yes, Nick, go ahead. You're on the air. Welcome to The Exchange.
Hey, I just wanted to thank you for taking my call today. And I just also wanted to note that this is the first time that I've ever been compelled to call into a radio show.
So, well, congratulations.
I wanted to speak a little bit. I have a little experience with what you guys are discussing today. I actually am a former foster child and an eventual adopted child. I had many siblings that also went through the foster program and the adoptive program as well.
Here in Iowa?
Here in the state of Iowa here. Mm-hmm. And I went through that process in the early and mid-80s, kind of what I would assume would be the last economic downturn for the U.S. And one couple of things I noticed from my perspective that seemed to be lacking in the programs at that point was, first of all, switching from a completely proactive stance to a reactive stance, in the fact that there was no attention ever given to children or people with problems unless the problems were brought up to somebody. Understanding that most kids in that type of situation are very vulnerable and they don't understand what they need to do in those types of situations. And also the fact that, you know, very specifically what I would note is I feel in the first year that I was in the foster and the adopted program, I visited with someone from social services, came to my family once a year. That was for the first 2 to 3 years. After that, no one ever showed up to check in, to see what was going on. And I don't fault the program. I think it's a lack of funding. I think it's a lack of attention brought to the issues. And I would just hate to see that happen again in these situations as well.
Okay, before we ask our guest to respond to that, to your specific case, Nick, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great, actually. I'm doing fine.
Okay, very good.
I will say that I can't necessarily say that for the other people that are in the same type of situation.
Let's get a response. Who in our Des Moines studio would like to address Nick's experience here and how perhaps that is a reflection of how child welfare has changed in this state?
Well, this is Mary, and one of the things I particularly was struck by Nick, you talked about, was the limited contact you had with your caseworker, the visit once a year, and that is one area that we have really put a push on over the last several years. We now, the expectation is that workers see kids monthly. We track that very closely, and it's an area where we've made some significant improvement. We're not at 100% yet, but we're definitely moving in the right direction.
What prompted those increased visits by caseworkers? Was there a high-profile case or just a case where you said, you know, it's obvious we got out of touch with this foster child. We should have been checking up much more often.
I think it was probably one of the most significant things that really brought it to our attention was it was one of the pieces of the federal review where we're measured on how frequently we're seeing kids, and we were surprised because it wasn't something we had routine data on previously, and we were surprised at how few cases were getting monthly visits, and that really brought attention to the issue, and we made a commitment that we were going to change that.
Mm-hmm. What about Nick's other point in terms of getting to prevent child abuse before it happens, before it becomes immediately apparent, rather than reacting?
That certainly makes the most sense. It is so much easier to prevent it in the first place than respond afterwards. If you look at the kind of resources that needed to be there to help Nick afterwards compared to what might have been able to help his family in the first place, usually much less to get it prevented in the first place.
So what are the tools you use to prevent it from happening in the first place? What do you find most effective?
Almost all families want to have their children be safe. They love their children. Unfortunately, a number of families have issues on occasion or more than one occasion where they maybe don't have the kind of parenting experience that would be helpful to approach situations, may not have any resources, are isolated. and facing a significant amount of stress. At that point, it's really important what's available in the community. And having community resources such as a crisis nursery setting where a parent's about ready to lose it or facing significant stress can leave off a child to get through that difficult period of time and maybe get some support and advice to turn things around. Having instruction for children or the children's parents or other adults on what is sexual abuse, what are some areas that where there might be risk.
How do you know
to prevent that from happening?
How do you know someone might need these prevention services?
We basically count on friends and families and professionals and neighbors to tell people that about resources that are available. They are able to call 211 or other resources to find out what's out there. Our local community groups that we work with, the programs we support, do outreach, basically getting information out to people as best we can.
Mm-hmm. Nick?
Can I make two comments before I leave you off air?
Okay, Nick. Yeah, quickly, go ahead. Nick from Iowa City.
My first comment I would like to make is I hope the quality of the visits have improved. My visits consisted of all the children being sat down in a separate room in front of a television, and the healthcare or the social service person meeting with my parents in a separate room for an hour, not even seeing them or talking to them at all. That would be my first point. My second point actually was brought up. I hope that the pushes that you're making in terms of making sure that kids aren't in the foster care system as long and things like that aren't having a backlash effect in terms of a lot of the adoptions that happened in my family, first of all, should never have happened in the first place. There's no reason why anyone should adopt this many children and not be able to care for them, and no one know that beforehand. So I'll leave you with those comments and take my answer off of there. Thank you very much.
Nick, nice to have you call, and nice to hear that you're doing well these days, if not always in the past. We had further comments from our Des Moines studio about Nick's case.
Well, this is Mary. I just want to pick up on the last point that Nick raised, because he made it's a really good point. The quality of the visit is it's important to see kids frequently, but we also need to make sure the quality is there. And that is a piece of the work that we're doing, where we are very specifically that the worker needs to be talking with the child, seeing how they're doing in school, how their health is, if there are any concerns, or if they feel safe in the foster home. So I think it's just a very good point that he made.
We talked at the outset about the approach to child welfare tending to swing like a pendulum, high-profile case like that of Shelby Dewis, swinging the pendulum toward protecting the child versus family preservation. Who can talk about where the pendulum is now? Are we more in the direction of parents' rights, protecting families, or to the children?
Why don't I start? I think the community partnership, which is what was mentioned earlier by Denise Moore, is an effort that tries to move closer to win-win. It is focused primarily on child safety, but there is the effort to engage families closer so that they are given an optimal opportunity to become the kind of parents that they would want to be. So we aren't necessarily in an either-or situation, but one where they're are good chances available to families, to parents, to, reach their optimal capability. And hopefully in those situations, we then have a child in a situation that is a good home and a safe home. And we don't have to make a choice where there's a home that is marginal or very bad and what to do with the child then.
There is an event tomorrow that I'd like to see if you had any of you had a comment about. The National Commission on Children and Disasters is holding a field visit in Cedar Rapids tomorrow. Federal, state, and local officials will be meeting to discuss the severe flooding and the tornadoes in 2008 and those unique challenges of disaster emergency response and recovery efforts for children. Does that cover any of your expertise, how children experience disasters, the extra sort of care they might need?
Well, this is Mary, and I'll jump in just a little bit. Certainly, one of the things I think that we experienced is that we needed to be be there for families and for foster families and provide additional supports to foster parents who were who may have been affected by the flood. And although our mental health division probably had, you know, had the most outreach in the area of the impact on kids, we certainly saw that it, I mean, it's a traumatic experience for kids and that you have to be very sensitive to the to some of what they're going through as they've lost the things that, you know, have personal meaning to them, their home, their connections, you know, in many cases having to change schools, their, you know, their stuffed toys, the things, you know, that have their, the photos, that it, it just, it, it, it's well more than just the loss of the physical, but the emotional ties that are impacted.
Let's go to a couple of emails. Terry in Davenport writes, it's my observation that unplanned children are more often products of abuse than planned children. Do you think that more emphasis should be placed on preventing unplanned pregnancies? What impact could, that have impact could that have on child abuse and neglect? Who wants to tackle that?
I think it's only logical that what the email writer shared is correct. I'm not aware of any studies that have tried to track the different outcomes for planned versus unplanned children, but certainly a family that's ready for a child, choosing to have a child, has a support for that child. Is bound to be getting off to a better start.
Here's an observation from Neil in an email. He says, my wife and I have taken the training to become foster and adoptive parents. I am also a non-custodial father for a three-year-old son. I am curious, Neil writes, how the panel feels that keeping both biological parents involved in the child's life would affect child abuse and neglect. Too often, times in divorce, one parent becomes isolated from the children, he writes. So I feel that legislative action would allow for a presumption of joint physical care that would help cut down the number of abuse and neglect cases. If both parents are allowed to be actively involved in the child's life, it would allow for an extra set of caring eyes to watch over that child. It can only benefit the child. What do you think of Neil's comment? Who wants to take that?
Well, this is Mary, and I'm maybe come at it just a little bit different angle. And I think one of the things that we have recognized in child welfare is that often when kids came into care, we really concentrated primarily on maintaining the relationship with the mother and connecting to what were the mother's needs and making sure that she got services. And in some cases, that was, you know, it was the child was coming from a single parent family. And I think we've really recognized over the years the importance of making sure that we're reaching out to the father. In many cases, it might be a non-custodial father, but that we're reaching out, finding out what his needs are. When we're looking at extended family, that we're not just thinking about the mother's family, but we're also thinking about the father's. So I think there has, and certainly in the public child welfare system, a recognition that kids benefit from having access to both and relationships with both their parents.
We have just about 3 minutes left, and I'd like to finish up with a comment from each of you, perhaps a thought that you might have that you felt wasn't emphasized enough. We didn't get to this hour. I want to start with Mary Nelson. After retiring after 35 years of work for the DHS, what do you call as some of your most satisfying work? Obviously, very dedicated, a passion of yours to be there in 35 years. What gave you the best sense of doing good for the community?
I think looking back at the work that we've done to strengthen and engage parent voice and youth voice, one of the things we didn't talk about very much is the in addition to our parent partner program, the Elevate group of current and former foster youth, and I think partnering more with our youth and parents is one of the things that I look back and feel has been one of the most beneficial and has real potential to continue to improve the system.
Mm-hmm. And Stephen Scott, Executive Director of Prevent Child Abuse Iowa, your final comments?
One comment I would make is that there has been some mention of the problem of the economy for families. The other impact of the economy, of course, is that it reduces government resources just at the time when families need them the most. So we really are in a situation, it's called counter-cyclical, where just when we need help the most is the time when we are most stretched to try to provide that help.
Mm. Let's throw that out to Gail and Denise as well. Are you concerned, Gail, first of all, how state budget woes may impact your program?
We're not concerned about the Children's Justice Program specifically, but certainly the court's budgetary issues, creating furlough days, will potentially delay hearings for juvenile cases, and that may delay permanency for our children. So that is of great concern, and the Chief Justice and the Supreme Court, of course, have made child welfare cases a priority. So we're watching carefully, but we do know that it'll be a challenge to hear those cases timely so that kids can get either returned home or into other permanent homes in a timely way.
Denise Moore, your final thoughts on the budget woes or otherwise in 30 seconds.
I'm just grateful that we had the opportunity to work with Mary because she has done so much to empower parents and youth in our system and change the way that families are looked at. And it's been an honor to have her.
Denise Moore, I want to thank you for joining us along with Gail Barber, Mary Nelson, and Stephen Scott. Thank you for showing up at our studios to have this discussion. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
The Exchange is produced by Catherine Perkins and Jeff Schmidt. Our producer assistant today, Kathleen Kroos. Technical support from Dennis Reese. Podcasting and on-demand audio of The Exchange available at iowapublicradio.org. And we always welcome your comments and questions about this program. Write to us at theexchange@iowapublicradio.org. Our theme music was composed and performed by Dan Knight. The Exchange is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.